Benzinga's Cannabis Capital Conference returns to Miami Beach on April 11th and 12th. I may be biased, but I'm telling you, this event is a can't miss. Join us to build the foundation of your next game-changing deal with CEOs and decision-makers from leading companies in the industry. We're talking about the next wave of businesses, strategies from the most profitable businesses, and exactly what investors are looking for in a challenging market. Go to bzcannabis.com to meet your next investor, co-founder, and new friends. A little pro tip from me, right now tickets are $1,000 cheaper than prices at the door. Get yours now. The nation's largest cannabis business brokerage, Green Life Business Group, gears up to be featured at the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference as one of the set speakers on our M&A panel. Green Life currently has over 150 exclusive cannabis businesses available on the market today, covering over 10 states. To see more of their exclusive listings, visit greenlifebusiness.com.
And we are live with another episode of Benzinga Cannabis Insider, celebrating what's left of Women's History Month. As you well know, this month, all of our guests are women. And today we have two amazing guests lined up for you. First off, we have Sundi Seafried. That is a little bit of a tongue twister. Sundi Seafried, CEO of Safe Harbor Financial, and Susi Plasencia, CEO of UMO. And we are joined by Mr. Elliot Lane, our national man of mystery.
A national man? Did you say national man of mystery? Because you're the international one. I love you.
Yeah, man.
I love you, Javi. Y'all, what's up?
Have matching names or nicknames.
All right, so you have to apologize. You have to apologize to me. No, I have to apologize to you all for being a few minutes late. I was just on one of our panel prep calls with a few awesome names like Trulieve, New Frontier Data, Clark Hill. We're gonna have a killer schedule for our event in a few weeks, y'all. It's
actually
gonna be exciting.
That is one of the most interesting panels we have, right? I know that you were preparing.
I agree.
For what other industries can teach us about identifying buyer personas?
Not everybody agrees, is what I'll say. They don't disagree in terms of the long term, but the short term, it's very interesting hearing these experts talk about buyer persona in the cannabis space right now, what it is, what we even know about it, and how that compares to other hospitality industries, food and beverage, and other formats that are similar to cannabis. But super interesting. And we've been doing those conversations for the last 2 weeks straight with these leaders. It's been really exciting. But that said, Javi, I didn't mean to derail you, my guy. It's just been crazy. Awesome listening to these experts just talk.
4 minutes of rapid fire news and just move on to the interviews.
3 minutes and 3 minutes of all Javier and maybe a comment from me here.
Big news today. I think the biggest news today was an exclusive I got actually out of Shoppers Drug Mart and Avicanna. Basically, what's happening is Shoppers Drug Mart was operating medical cannabis by Shoppers. This the top retail store for cannabis in Canada, for medical cannabis, of course. They decided to transition their business to Avicanna after months of looking into different potential partners. They landed on our good friends at Avicanna, AVCNF in the OTC and AVCN on the TSX. The medical cannabis by Shoppers has been active since 2019. They offered 30 licensed brands, served tens of thousands of patients, and now they're transitioning. The new website is called mymedi.ca, MyMedica. Will launch in May of 2023, operated by both Medical Cannabis by Shoppers and Avicanna, and then they will transition so that Avicanna takes over. But for those patients looking for products that are not created by Avicanna, whether that's, I don't know, like Replay, I think they got like Ro Phyto, they collaborate with Al Harrington and Viola, but they are also continuing to offer all of the other brands, and they will just be operating this marketplace. The reason they were selected, Shoppers told me, is because they are a biopharma company. So they really want this to have a very medical approach. The stock popping, interesting to check out.
20% almost, up 19.81%, which is about a 5 cent increase.
That is
the 33 cents.
I know, wow, man.
Yeah, ABC and F there. That's awesome, man. Congrats to that team. They've been around for a bit. You know, Latin American players. You know, there's only a few that you know I would say are not worth mentioning, but we consistently mention. And Avicanna has been one for many, many years prior to me joining Benzinga about 5 years ago now. But Javi, what else, man? Give us like two more news items that we should be looking at today.
We got Ayr Wellness, AYRWF, exiting the Arizona market. Our good friend Pablo Swanich at Cantor Fitzgerald calling it a good move. You can go to benzinga.com/cannabis to find out why. But after the show, we had another exclusive cannabis extracts producer, Jetty, enter the New York market, partnering with small family-owned farms. And Sundial will acquire 4 Dutch Love cannabis dispensaries. I say Sundial because SNDL is hard to say, but
it is.
No, they, SNDL is
both. They rebranded to a terrible, like, why can't we still call it Sundial? I'm not a marketer, but at the end of the day, like, Sundial, SNDL, or Birkenstock Sandals. Like, I mean, it can go so many ways with it. I don't know. But that being said, SNDL. In the news again, Zach George will also be speaking at the event. So y'all, this is not, it's not really been a busy week, I think, from a public company standpoint. The Ayr news is one of the more interesting pieces of public company news I've seen over the past couple of days. Mm-hmm. Lots happening on the state side. So just a quick rundown. We may get a vote tomorrow from Kentucky on medical cannabis. We have a few other states looking to enter into recreational, where ideally we'll get some news on Delaware. Hopefully that governor doesn't veto it again. But there could be some state catalysts here soon, and that's exciting. So keep an eye on Javi and his amazing news desk, benzinga.com/cannabis, for all their content. Tons to prepare for the event as well. So see a lot of really cool perspectives from leaders and just, you know, Javier's coverage of it on site. So with that said, Javi, anything else, man, before we talk to people who are way cooler than us?
I mean, not really. Just, I don't know. You know, the fun one, Kiva and Fat Burger joined forces to launch a THC.
Great name. Ketchup. Great name. Makes me want a cheeseburger immediately.
What do you think of the pun? Candiment instead of condiment.
Fat Burger is better. no, it's fine. I will say I am a big condiment fan, so it has a lot to live up to. Mayonnaise, ketchup, mustard, barbecue sauce. I'll take all of them. I am not a condimentist.
Just finish the show, whatever. We're done.
So, fun fact, my wife cannot eat chicken without mayonnaise. Can't do it.
That is interesting.
Yeah. You know, we're in our 30s. It's fine. So we're children still. It's cool. All right. Javier, my guy, I'm sorry. I'm derailing us from talking about cannabis.
Let's get our first guest on. I'm going to get it right this time. Sundie Seafried, CEO of Safe Harbor Financial. Woohoo!
Welcome back, Sundie. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me again.
Oh my God. So excited.
I'm foreign. I don't know if I massacred your name there. Can you say it for us?
Perfect. And oh, by the way, there isn't enough ketchup in my life. I just have to agree with you, Elliot.
Sundie, we're on the same page. Javi, you can go now. No, Sundie, so you've actually been with us before. And it was before, if I remember right, you had just a stream of news. You've had a really exciting I think last 6 to plus months. So do you just want to catch us up a little bit about what Safe Harbor is doing right now?
Sure. So we actually went public at the end of September and did a reverse SPAC. So the de-SPAC process is never easy. In hindsight, we know exactly what that looks like. And shortly thereafter, you know, we inherited a lot of debt at that point in time with our parent company and, of course, Partner Colorado Credit Union, our major stockholder and parent company, gave us a forbearance agreement because that wasn't the way the deal was supposed to fall out, and gave us 6 months to renegotiate some type of structure that will allow us to succeed long term. And that, I have to say, is coming to an end of time for negotiating. So feeling pretty optimistic there. And then we did a merger with a quasi-competitor, Abaca, And what that did was give us a final piece to our platform software that's all proprietary, fintech platform that allows us to manage all the client relationships amongst multiple financial institutions. And of course, the rest I can't talk about until
you can.
That's your earnings call, right? Another thing you probably cannot talk about, but I'm going to push you and see what happens, right? I know that you will have to say everything was great, but since you mentioned that of course the process of going public, the reverse takeover, is a complex process. Can you give us the good, the bad, and the ugly of going public?
Well, going public. I'm trying to think of good here.
In this space, it's hard.
First of all, you have to know I come from a not-for-profit background, right? And very regulated. So we were used to filing reports on a quarterly basis. So what I'm not used to doing is keeping everything so totally insider, totally secret, and so many months behind. It's like, you know, we're going to have an earnings call soon. And the problem is we're only going to be talking about fourth quarter in 2022. And, you know, there's good things happening in 2023. So I think to me, that's very difficult because I like to share the good. So still working on that.
Let me ask you another question here. You know, many people in this, I would say, as we look at the cannabis industry, we see lenders as being very valuable and necessary to the liquidation and capital flow of the space as it stands right now. Now, that being said, you're also providing that service to your fellow institutions, if I heard that correctly. And I'm not sure how common that is, nor how well spoken that is, but that seems to be something that is very interesting to me, and how you work with other institutions in the space and how you support them versus, you know, the service you provide them and that's needed by them could be an interesting point for us to dive into.
Yeah. So, you know, the credit part of that is probably the most interesting part. You know, we select very solid partners, financial institutions at this point in time. We help them set up a program. We can move deposits, which everybody likes, deposits into their base. And then because, I know, especially in this time and age, right? And the more deposits we have on, the more that we can loan out. And our competitive advantage there is that we aren't going to the capital markets to get that capital to loan out. We are able to loan against our own deposits, which gives us a very low cost of funds. Some of the loans, we have loans on the books as low as 7.5%, very, very low. And then we have them up there to like 13%. But that's the higher risk is those companies that probably are doing construction, or maybe we've taken a license as collateral. But the low end is for just really solid real estate. And because we're still a new company, we want to make sure we go into this in a very conservative manner so as to not lose confidence with the market one way or another.
How does that work?
One more point. The network of financial institutions, hear how it works to the advantage of the cannabis industry when we are issuing credit facilities. Say we get an $80 million request. And at one financial institution, that could be too big for that financial institution due to concentration risk. We can spread that out amongst our financial institutions and participate it, which allows us the opportunity to serve that large facility and also spread the risk out amongst the financial institutions.
Is that common? And then Javi, you can jump in. I apologize. Is that common in these other lenders that are so in the spotlight?
I do not know if it's like really common for, like, if you're talking about like a Gamma or something like that. But when you get into financial institutions that are regional and community, yes, it's common.
I come from a country, I'm from Argentina. For those watching, they already know I talk about this a lot, right? But we have we're very used to inflation. Inflation is 80 to 100% per year. So we always think it in terms of inflation, right? So you're saying like the lower end of a loan there or a financing facility that you would provide would be at 7%. And you know, I instantly think like that's a little bit below inflation currently. How does that work? Like, is it, I really, like, I would like to understand how it works. Is it thought, just like for the benefit of these businesses, for them to build toward the future, or is it also like beneficial to Safe Harbor?
No to Safe Harbor, but here's how it works. You know, this particular loan that was under 8% was issued prior to this raising rate environment. So that borrower got in at the right time, secured it. But the way we do it is you rewrite the loan every 5 years and you change the rate according to the market. So right now, anybody who's been in underwriting, we've been honoring some of those rates that are lower, but we do have to adjust up with rising rates at this point. But we still, the way we normalized depository services is what we'd like to do with lending in the industry. You know, access to capital at reasonable rates and reasonable terms. There's always going to be a premium just due to the fact that it is a cannabis that's illegal at the federal level. We have to go through special third parties. We're not allowed to touch the plant. So we have to, the legal work is much more severe in these loans. And then you have to really put a lot of clauses in there based upon the state in which you're loaning to. And some of our clients have properties in 4 or 5 states. So you can imagine the amount of legal work that has to go into underwriting those loans.
Can you give me a sense? This is a little bit of a shift, so I apologize for this, but there's obviously been a lot of banking news recently, for better or worse, mostly worse. But, you know, we have seen a lot of M&A in that space and or takeovers. We've seen a lot of panic. How at large, and this is more just your perspective, Sundi, than anything specific to Safe Harbor, how has the cannabis space been impacted by what's happened over the last couple of weeks?
There's some really good points here to make out about what's going on. The first point I'll make out is that, good for the industry to some extent, most of the banks and credit unions have been serving our community, and they're small, regional, not into venture capital loans to the extent that these other banks were into, not taking the risk because they're not big enough to take that risk. That's the good news. So those banks that most of the cannabis companies are in, not so impacted because the risk of the portfolio of that bank isn't as risky as what you saw in Signature or in SVB. So the second point that I'd like to make out here is that this is really interesting because I understand that Signature had cannabis accounts in it. So everybody's asked me from day one in 2015, are my funds insured because I'm a cannabis company? And for 8 years, I've had to say, they haven't revoked the insurance certificate at the federal level from any of our financial institutions. However, it's never been tested. Nobody's ever tested this federal insurance to see if they're covering. Now we may just see the test and what happens if it's true and Signature has those cannabis accounts. How do they handle them? If they're being if they're going to be acquired, what's the acquirer going to do with them? If FDIC has to jump in, that's going to be a very interesting point to watch on this situation with the banks right now.
I can only imagine. And but thank you for not weaseling out of any of the tough questions. Like, you were super honest there. I appreciate it. People, especially in public companies, they give you like very softball questions, like just, you know, trying to get out. It's like, okay, things are tough. Now, you authored this book, Navigating Safe Harbor, Cannabis Banking in Uncertain Times. Times are still uncertain. You wrote this book in 2016. What has changed? What is still the same? Has anything proved in the last, I don't know, like 70 years?
Ooh.
First, let me tell you that I have taken that book off the market. And here's why. When we acquired Abaca and the management team came to us, they were very clear about one thing, that they had two documents in their hands when they started their company. They had the FinCEN guidance and my book. And the board was like, stop giving your knowledge away any further, right? So the book is no longer available. So what has changed since 2016? You know, nothing on the compliance side has changed. There's still a massive amount of compliance and reporting that has to be done on these companies. What everything else has changed, you know, mom and pops came in that door. They were struggling. The cash was on the streets. Good changes there with the banking access. But then we got into the complex multi-state operators, and we got into vertical integration, and we've got a lot of consolidation going on. So keeping up with this market, it means that every time you turn around, you're mitigating a new risk. So the program is constantly under scrutiny and updates to make sure that we stay up with the market. But I always say that I'd like to say it was brilliant getting us this far and living through going public. But, you know, the fact of the matter is there was a need in the cannabis industry, and all I did was build a program around the needs of the industry and keep up with them. I just kept following with that front row seat, never got bored. It's too interesting, like you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there is an interesting crossover here for you specifically, because you deal with such an intense movement of money as a fintech company. In a capital markets company, but fintech itself is highly difficult for cannabis investors to really break into actively. Is there a crossover there that maybe the industry isn't exploring with fintech at its end, whether it's in payments on that side, whether it's in capital markets investing, that maybe investors can be looking into as more advantageous ways to benefit from investing in cannabis?
Well, there's a lot of points there. First, I'll say that I just came back from a Canadian tour. 4 cities, 42 investors, 4 days.
Wow.
Right? What I found in Canada is that they want to get into the cannabis industry, but not all direct plant touching. So they found us an attractive option should we be able to handle this debt situation. And they found us as attractive because financial services will always be needed in this cannabis industry with or without consolidation. So fintechs, and the second thing I'll say is that our objective as a fintech and utilizing our reliable brand that we've built over the last 8 years is that we want to bring some of the best pioneers to the table who have also managed through payments, through insurance, through these other, all these situations, and bring them under one roof so that the industry has one good fintech platform for all their financial services. So yes, I think that, you know, we went through that de-SPAC just as the SPAC market was crashing. So we had some issues there with investors falling out. But on the whole, they were very receptive to what we were doing. Obviously, now it's about executing and resolving this debt issue and getting that stock price back to reflect the value of the company.
Sundi, thank you so much for that. It's very helpful just hearing like where the money is right now and how it is being made in this industry from a financial standpoint. But if you could give us one word that we as investors, as cannabis consumers and participants can be excited for in the year ahead, is there anything in the capital markets side of this that you can point to or maybe say, hey, just keep an eye on that. This could be really good.
Well, you know, I think we're going through a natural correction in the market right now. And people think it's just doom and gloom, but I think it's just increased competition. Everybody used to fly to Colorado to get their cannabis and go on vacation. Mm-hmm. Now they aren't, right? So now all the other states are getting it and we're losing some of those sales. So I don't think it's doom and gloom. I think it's competitive pressures that are actually on the market, you know, pushing it down for consumers, but those companies that pivot and adjust are going to be the ones I think that are going to be there for the long term.
Amen. Sundi, well said. Thank you so much. Sundi Seafried, CEO of Safe Harbor Financial. Amazing insights today. Thank you for discussing banking, for Safe Harbor, for insights into fintech. And of course, it's not all doom and gloom. We should put that on a t-shirt for our conference in a few weeks, which we will see Safe Harbor at. So if y'all like this, please buy a ticket and see them there. But Sundi, thank you so much again.
Thank you, Elliot. Thank you, Javier.
Thank you.
Awesome. Killer interview. Awesome interview.
Cautious optimism and realism are really my cup of tea. I really
I'm glad to hear it, Javier.
Maybe I'm like numbers nerd or something, but this was like super enjoyable.
It was. I thought it was a very good interview. However, we are not done.
Also super enjoyable. The cannabis produced by our next guest.
Ooh, so okay.
Cynthia is the CEO of Humo Cannabis by La Raza, for La Raza. Where there's fuego, there's humo. Let's bring her on.
That was the most like verbally delectable introduction we've ever given her, Susie. I hope you enjoyed that. And Javi, thank you for that. But Susie, welcome in. How are you?
I did enjoy that quite a bit. I was in the backstage like going, woo! I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start off with a bit of an introduction. Talk to us a little bit about Humo and then how you made your journey to cannabis.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me. So Humo, we're California's award-winning Mexican-American owned and woman-led cannabis brand. We're the first of our kind. We saw that there was an opportunity in the market for representation of Latinos, both Latinos as the people that, you know, dealt with the war on drugs in the U.S., right? But also as people who are the backbone of this industry and throughout the California area, we saw an opportunity to represent them on the shelves, but also show many Latinos that when you are Latino and you have this these traditions that you follow, they don't end when you kind of succumb to your cannabis, you know, self as well. Sometimes a lot of Latinos in this industry, we have identity issues. You know, we have to be one way when we're at home and with our family. We have to be another way when we love our cannabis use. So with Humo, we're that brand that is blending people and their culture together with their love of cannabis.
I understand, Javi, I apologize, because I know you're super excited about this interview. But I really, is that not what we should be doing across the entire industry? And, you know, however, I want to bring this back to what you're doing in, you know, looking at doing it for one culture, because not all cultures can be, you know, marketed to in the same way, I would imagine. So can you chat a little bit as brand partner? Is that not something that, you know, cannabis should be striving for in every corner of this industry?
Absolutely. I think it's something that, you know, at the end of the day, Latino culture is marketing friendly, right? When we look at holidays like Cinco de Mayo, these are holidays that the alcohol industry really took on. And when you look at what this holiday has become, it was meant for sales. But the problem is that these sales always go back to the companies and not necessarily the people or the culture behind the people, right? So in cannabis, we have our eyes set on Cinco de Mayo as well, but our purpose is representation and making sure that all the sales come back and benefit our people. So with Humo, we are one of the first brands that we are Latino owned, but because of our parent company, Possible Project, Possible is Latino owned and grown as well. So we are Latino owned and grown through and through. Where you support Humo, you're supporting our farm workers, you're supporting our leadership, and you're supporting Latinos and cannabis at the end of the day. So while the alcohol companies, you know, it was more about sales and bottom line because they are using Latino culture because it appeals to us, with us, all of that, but comes down to ownership and the fact that all the money comes back to supporting our organization, which provides jobs for a lot of Latinos.
I love that. I want to ask you two questions back to back, both related to stigma, if that is okay. You mentioned one of them is like, you know, being one person in your general life and one very different person with your family, right? A recent poll by the Harris poll showed that 37% of American women consume cannabis, but most of them keep it a secret from their parents, their children, and their coworkers. Do you see this stigma going away? Is it more or less present in the Latino community? Like, what can you say about this in general? What are your thoughts? Man.
It is larger and more apparent in the Latino community because, yes, our Latinos as a whole, we have identity issues because some of us work in the industry, right? And we should be proud of it. But sometimes we have to hide it from our parents, from our family members. And when it comes to other industries, I'd be happy to tell my uncle or my aunt that I'm a brand partner at a major cannabis brand, but or a major brand. But because it's cannabis, I have to find a way of like how do I tell them in a way that makes me not seem like a major drug dealer, right? But and that those are the things that we have to deal with as Latinos. But as women, on top of that, women are mothers. So that's an added layer of, are you a responsible parent, right? Are you neglecting your children? All of these negative, you know, stereotypes of what it is to be a cannabis user. When at the same time, those aren't applied to alcohol, right? It's fine for a mom, mm-hmm. You know, to have a glass of wine, but God forbid she has a joint, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that in general, I think that is prevalent, but how we change that is by having brands like Umo. Part of Umo is normalization. And part of our branding is making sure that people are proud of their cannabis use. We want people to be loud and proud about their cannabis use, but in order for that to happen, these brands need to be available. These brands need to be accessible. And what's great about Umo is we're at over 200 dispensaries throughout the California state. So now all those Latinos who haven't really felt like they're part of the cannabis industry, that aren't really feel like they're included, now feel that way. When you go into dispensary, Umo on our packaging, it says Raza owned. And that was intentionally done because we want people to know that we are holding space for you on the shelf in a way that really hasn't been before.
I love that. And the second question also relates to stigma, right? I've had this conversation with a lot of people, you know, in the cannabis industry, especially the movement also, but mostly in the cannabis industry, the word marijuana is frowned upon. But it's ours, right? Like, how do you feel about this situation where they go like, okay, this carries stigma, you're not allowed to say it, but then it's ours and you appropriated it and now we can't say it. Like, where do you stand on the marijuana debate?
You know, this is an interesting topic that I actually discussed just a couple days ago. I was up in the Modesto area because we had an event up there. And I was talking to another mission-focused brand that they're not Latino-oriented in any way at all, but they hired a consultant to actually help them with it. And this consultant was like, do not use the word marijuana. Do not use it. Do not use it. And this particular brand partner talked to me and said, hey, Susie, is that the truth? And I said, it's conflicting. Like all things regarding our culture, there are several sides to it. I think it just depends on where do you stand, right? And so this is where I stand. The word marijuana was weaponized. It was weaponized specifically for the Latino community. And I think a lot of the stigma that we still are faced with, it always comes down to this particular word, right? Because Ari Anslinger, he didn't use the other slang terms. He didn't use mota or even other words, right? But he used this one word. And we are still dealing with the impact of the fact that that was a decision that he made, right? But this is exactly what I told this other brand partner. It was our word that he took to weaponize against us. So if we are, what my stance is if we are looking to use it, we have to explain it. So when I have used it in the past, I have used it in an empowering way. I have used it and I'm explaining why I'm using it. I don't just use it in the same way that I use cannabis, because cannabis is medicinal, right? It's more business-centric, more business-friendly.
That's what my parents would say. Mi hijo no trabaja en marihuana, trabaja en cannabis. He doesn't work in marijuana. He works in medical cannabis. It's a different thing. That was 2014. Now they're into whatever. It's like, yeah, just say it.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. I don't alienate myself from it. I do strategically use cannabis because of the conversations that are had around this word are just more serious about business and what I'm about business, right? We're getting down to business. When I use marijuana, it's intentional. It's when I'm calling out the stigma or I'm intentionally use it to spark a conversation that's going to talk about that. So I would say that if you're going to use whatever term, be intentional about it and be ready to answer, you know, the questions that come around that word, because it's not a simple word. It's charged.
It's weird. It's like the product mirroring of the industry at large, between corporate and culture, in a weird way. That being said, the ultimate goal is to somewhat bring those two together. and is somewhat to make it top to bottom, cannabis and marijuana have their places in marketing and communication to the consumer, but you know, it's not necessarily alienating from each other. So that being said, it all comes down to that communication with a consumer. And, you know, I guess my thought here is how you're building UMO, and how you're expanding, how you're growing in the US, you know, as a brand partner. Some commentary that I've heard from, you know, kind of maybe more on the corporate side leaders is that some of the strain names that we see now are very, you know, 5-10 years ago, right? They're like, you know, not Purple Haze, but like as a new consumer, you're like, what the heck is Purple Haze? Like, I don't understand that. I'm not like a history buff of marijuana, right? So how do we bridge the gap of understanding what we're consuming and not having to teach a whole playbook of strains and terpenes that, you know, kind of the more active consumers we have right now know? How do we communicate that to those that maybe be entering the space as consumers?
Yeah, so we have a really interesting strain naming process that I lead here with UMO. So our R&D process over at the farm is pretty impressive, right? They have a 12-acre farm over at Possible, and they're constantly getting some of the best strains that the market has through their amazing breeder partnerships. So when a strain is about to come into UMO, we have a lot of testing that has to go down with it, right? We have to make sure it has a taste profile, it performs in every way, and then it gets sent over to me, right? I do my R&D process, which always includes a freshly clean bong. We have to make sure that we take in all the terps. And what I do before I name a strain is I truly experience the strain. I taste it. I note down all the characteristics. I really take in the feeling and try to note down that as well. And then I try to name a strain that communicates that with the people. I'm actually a former bud tender. I was a bud tender over 12 years ago, and I really look for that experience for this particular aspect of the brand. One of the things that I dealt with as a bud tender was serving our patients and with the exact strain that is going to serve the ailment that they're trying to treat. So we would have patients coming in with depression, anxiety, you know, nausea and that sort of thing. And I would be constantly trying to find a strain that can help them. But we had strain names like AK-47, right? Purple Haze. How can I know how to give them and suggest a strain that's going to help them when I don't really know, you know, what they're serving me, right? So with UMO, when I do this R&D process, I pick out those flavors. I pick out the terpene content, all of those things, and I match a name that both captures the culture of what UMO represents, but also gives a window in to the terpene expression, the flavor, the taste, the scent, and the experience. So I have an example. Our award-winning strain, I named it Limonada. I named it Limonada because the crosses are pink lemonade number 2 crossed with huckleberry soda. When you open up this jar and package, you get a burst of the lemon. You get a burst of that sweet tart. So it took me back and transported me when I was in Santee Alley's here in downtown LA buying Mexican Limonada. It is this tart, delicious lemon lemonade, but Mexican lemonade is a little different. It's kind of just like how Mexican Coke is different from regular Coke. This one's a little sweeter, a little more tart, and it has chia seeds at the bottom. It's something that a lot of LA Latinos grew up drinking, and a lot of Latinos from all over the world as well, they have their own type of lemonade here. So that's what it took me back to. So I named it Limonada because that was the experience that I had. And what we've been seeing is that people all throughout the state are having that same feeling. They're opening up that bag and they're getting taken back to that Limonada moment. So that's kind of the experience that I like to give through naming the strains. No surprises here. It's what you're going to experience.
Love that. That is awesome. Awesome. Any concluding thoughts, any last thoughts for our audience? Anything on business and on inclusion, on Women's History Month, whatever you want to share?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's Women's Month still. We're towards the end. I think that this time is really important because as a marketing veteran, when I entered cannabis, I was waiting for the good marketing and PR. I was waiting for it, but it wasn't there yet. It has gotten there. And these holidays, these special moments, this is when we get a chance to shape the industry. Mm-hmm. We get a chance to cast our vote by going into dispensaries and voting for which brands should survive this crazy industry that we're in. So if you guys are looking for women-owned brands, for women-led brands to survive and thrive, this is your time to do it. Go to those dispensaries and ask, where is your women-owned shelf? Some of these dispensaries are going to be like, we need one. Boom. Guess who's going to win? Women-led and women-owned brands. We are also stepping into 420. We're stepping into Cinco de Mayo. These are all chances for consumers to actually have a say into what the direction of the industry is going to be. Is it going to be white men or is it going to be women and people of color? It's not up to us. It's up to the consumers. So if you guys are looking to make sure that the industry goes the way it needs to, inclusion, more women, then go out there and vote. Go out there and vote with your wallet. And that's something that we have been able to really see the impact of. UMO launched February 4th, 2022, and we made it to a top 50 cannabis brand as of October. That is the most, that is a hard thing to do. That is, I think we have to.
Well done. Well done.
Thank you so much. But it's not just us. It's people going into the dispensaries and asking for UMO. They'll go in there and actually ask, do you carry UMO? And if they don't, and sometimes they have walked right out and been like, let me know when that changes. And then we get a phone call from our agency saying, our sales agency saying, oh, you guys are the first brand to ever galvanate a base, you know, to do this kind of action. And we have our community to thank, but ultimately it shows that Latinos have not been recognized for way too long. And for UMO to be doing this, it feels like a true mission that we're on. It feels like something that we were meant to do. And in a lot of ways, I definitely feel lucky to be in this position that I am now.
I love that. We have festivities every month for the next few months where you can show support for different brands, show your support for women brands, women-owned brands in March, show your support for Latino-owned brands in May. 420, any minority or any brand you want to support. Then we have Juneteenth. Then we have 710. Just make your choices consciously.
That love part. That. And again, Cinco de Mayo, it was used by the alcohol companies to benefit from Latino culture. We now have the ability in cannabis to take that holiday back and make it about ownership and Latinos. And that's what we're trying to do. So that Cinco de Mayo, that is all about UMO. So
dry Cinco de Mayo. Cinco de Mayo. That is what we'll call it going forward. Yes. No alcohol, just weed on that day.
I feel like we need to kind of create a different name, like Cinco de Cannabis or something like that. Like Cinco, I don't know. I'll circle back. My marketing brain is turning right now.
There we go. Well, let us know, Susie. But Susie, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Love the work you're doing. And please keep us updated on what's next for you.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Two great interviews. Two strong, strong women leaders in this industry. It was awesome to have both Sundi and Susie on today.
Love this.
Yeah.
BZCannabis.com, the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference, is coming back to Miami, April 11th and 12th. On the 13th, we also have Psychedelics. There's the QR. Elliot can point in the right direction. I never get that right with the mirroring of the screens. But make sure to get your tickets. You can use the code HOBBY20 to get a discount. Don't tell anyone. This is a secret just for our viewers.
Thanks, Javi.
And just come join us. We'll have a lot of, you know, this is a representative conference. We'll have a lot of women. We partnered up again with Women Grow, Minority for Medical Marijuana, BIPOCAN. So we really focus on diversity, inclusion, and creating a safe space for women to feel comfortable.
It's never enough. This is not us tooting our own horn. It is us saying, if you are a minority-owned business, a women-owned business, a veteran-owned business, somebody affected by the war on drugs, we want you at our event. We want you represented and we want to help. So reach out to us, events@benzinga.com. Get a ticket, apply for one of our scholarship tickets. We want you there. That said, Javier, love you, my guy. We are over. We got to wrap this up. This was a lot of fun. Javier's the best. Susie and Sunday are amazing, amazing interviews. Like and share. Subscribe to this podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter and buy a ticket to our event. And that's it, y'all. We will see you again. Today's Tuesday on Thursday at 4 o'clock. Peace. Yeah.